Today on the Relationship Renovation Podcast, we have a beautiful story of a couple, their amazing ability to be really present for each other, even when they're like built differently, and a journey that they took through the infertility experience and how they navigated it in a graceful way, even though it was incredibly difficult.
Hello, all, and welcome to the Relationship Renovation Podcast. I'm Tara Kerwin.
And my name is EJ Kerwin. And, you know, we're excited. We occasionally have the opportunity to interview a couple. And as we were sort of beginning today and just talking about setting this up, like one of the things that couples enjoy listening is they love to hear other people's stories. Mm-hmm. You know, they love to hear because oftentimes, you know, the ups and downs of relationship, we sort of like we're isolated in it. It's behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when we hear stories of other couples, it has a way of just being like, oh, like I'm not alone. Or, wow, that thing they say, I like totally relate to that. And so we're really glad to have Alan and Casey. Casey's a therapist. Alan's a lawyer, so he happily agreed, or he agreed to be here today.
Was there a contract?
Yeah. She asked me if I wanted to do it. I said no. And then she asked me if I would do it. So I'm here.
Right on, oh, right on. Thank you for being here. Yeah. So Casey's a therapist here with us at Relationship Renovation, and she did an amazing in-service for our staff on grief, infertility, pregnancy loss. And then within that training, she said that a lot of her training and knowledge comes also from her own story. And of course, I was like, oh, I wonder if she would be willing to share her story with us. And we actually don't know this story. And she agreed. So I can't say how grateful we are that you two are here. And we can't wait to just hear your story.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
I appreciate being here.
Well, I mean, so let's just get to know you guys a little bit. Like, I know Casey a little bit, but I know her mostly professionally. Alan just met you this morning. I mean, so can you tell us just like your origin story? Like, how did you guys meet? Where did you meet? Like, tell us a little bit about just the two of you.
Well, I'm from rural Kentucky. Alan grew up in Las Vegas, and we met in 2011 on Match.com.
I love it.
We actually, on January 25th, was our Match.com anniversary. That was the day that I sent him an email.
Does Match, like, send you something saying that your anniversary or anything?
No.
Or you just knew?
No, we just knew. That was, like, the day I reached out to him. I was like, oh, he's cute.
And you were in Kentucky? You were in Vegas? When?
No, I had moved to Kentucky.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I left Vegas during the recession in 2009. Mm. Moved to Kentucky looking for work. And then end of 2010, early 2011, I went ahead and got a couple of dating accounts.
Yeah.
And I met her after just a couple of months. She actually reached out to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Had you ever done that before? Had you ever done
no.
it? No.
No.
You little pursuer, you, Casey.
Well, he kept, at the time, it would show you if people had viewed your profile. Wow. And his picture kept showing up at the top.
He was checking out.
It was like for a week. And I was like, this guy has done nothing. Like, what? But he keeps looking at me. So there must be interest. So
do you remember,
I just took the initiative.
Do you remember that? Do you remember looking? Yeah.
I hadn't figured out exactly how I wanted to reach out to her yet.
Yeah.
This is so cute.
Yeah. Was that like just like a weird place to be? I'm just curious, like the whole, because I remember Tara actually, when I was going through a divorce, found mine and was like, because we were friends, and was like couldn't believe I think it might have been Match. Like,
well, because you had just recently like separated, and I was like, you're already on Match.com. Let me be your wing sister. That's right. Yeah, you had your profile on Match.com. Yeah, anyway, okay.
Was it weird just being in that space?
Yeah, I didn't really enjoy the entire process, but I didn't have any friend networks. I didn't know anybody.
You just moved there.
Yeah, I had just, I'd been there about a year, I guess, at that point, but I had moved a couple of different towns, and I was just settling into my job, so I didn't really know anyone.
Yeah.
So I figured, well, let's try the internet and see what happens.
Yeah.
And I guess that's pretty normal now, but at the time.
Yeah, it was a little weird, so sure, right? Yeah, it felt like, yeah.
It was newer.
In each other's profiles, just curious, like, what were you drawn to about each other?
His honesty it was just like a breath of fresh air for me. He was just so, it seemed so authentic. You know, it didn't seem like he was trying to like sell himself. He had really good grammar and punctuation. And I was an editor of a newspaper at that time, a copy editor. So that was very important to me.
That's one of the telltale signs.
Like, everything is spelled correctly.
Yeah.
How about you? What were you drawn to?
She was pretty, top of the list. And she seemed... She was smarter than most of the other profiles I was looking at.
Like you could tell.
You could just tell by reading what she wrote that that she was intelligent, able to carry on a conversation.
Yeah.
And, you know, that matters to me a lot. So.
Yeah. So how did you guys navigate that online life to real life?
Yeah, we didn't really have much online interaction.
Yeah.
She reached out to me and within, a week and a half, we had our first date.
Yeah, about 2 weeks.
Yeah.
We had a phone call. Yeah, our first phone call was 3 hours.
Really?
Yeah.
Just getting to know each other.
Yeah, I was working nights at the newspaper at that time, and there was like a late basketball game, so I had to wait until it was over. So there's this dead time. So we had our conversation. I remember like sitting in the lobby of the newspaper office talking to him. It's like midnight. We're like on the phone for 3 hours.
Wow.
And then our first date was rainy. It was in February. So it was a couple weeks. And then we got married in August.
Oh, wow. It happened fast for you guys.
That's 6 months, right?
Yeah.
Will you tell us the story of the proposal?
There wasn't much of a proposal.
That's still a story.
Yeah, there wasn't much of one.
How did you guys decide or what was the process?
I'm not sure there was a process. I think I said, yeah, I could see marrying you. And she said, really? And I said, oh, yeah, I'd do that. Totally. And then we decided we were going to do that.
Really? I was like, awesome. Yeah, I agree. I think this is pretty good. But I told him, like, we're not telling. There has to be a proposal before we tell anybody.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not. There has to be a ring. Like, you have to get down on your knee. Like, if we're going
to
do this,
you have to be on the podcast. We get it, Casey. We get it.
So it was a couple of weeks. And then he did, like, a very formal, you know, we celebrated with some Guinness and gave me a ring and and then that was in May.
Yeah, we did that on, you were actually going home for the weekend.
I was, which was really interesting to get home and then to tell my parents, like, surprise.
Well, and that's why we split a Guinness instead of opening a bottle of champagne. She just stopped by my apartment. I asked formally, I gave her the ring. We toasted with Guinness, and then she was on her way.
She's like, I'm off to tell my parents.
Yep.
Had you met her parents yet?
No.
Yeah, we went up for Hannah. Hannah had a musical at one of my sisters.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that would have been right about, that was close in time.
Yeah, it was probably a month before.
At most.
Yeah, and then I met your mom at Joy's baby shower she had. Yeah. So I'd met his mom, but I hadn't met his dad.
Yeah. Yeah.
So dating 3 months, proposed, wedding 6 months later.
Yeah. Yeah. We got, so we got the proposal in May and then in August we got married. We eloped. We went to Gatlinburg, Tennessee.
Pigeon Forge.
Yeah. Pigeon. Yeah. I mean, they're kind of
the same. So what year is this again? 2011. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's the year we started dating, honey.
It was.
So cute. It is.
Yeah. So it was just us. I mean, our families knew we were getting married, but and, you know, I never really cared, like, about a big wedding or anything. And my parents eloped, and I always thought it was kind of romantic.
How old were you guys?
So, I was 28.
30.
20 and 30.
You guys are, like, about the same age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And then do you guys move in after?
Mm-hmm.
So, you guys, okay, very traditional?
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, we, she had a bachelorette party on the night I was moving all of our stuff into the apartment.
Yeah.
And then, was it the next day or the day after we drove down to get married?
Yeah. Yeah, we drove down on a Monday. Gosh. Got married at the chapel at 4 o'clock. Everything was done by 4:20. We were like,
yep.
You guys like it simple. I love it.
Yeah.
It's what it feels like, simplicity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it still feels like loving and caring and exciting, but simple.
Mm-hmm.
Like so many people go crazy around wedding and wedding planning and just feels like so simple.
Yeah, it was. It was like, so really special. We spent 3 days there. It was just, I don't know, such a great way to kick off our life together. And we had so much fun and no doubts.
What was it like early on in relationship with each other? Like, what was the vibe?
Well, for me, with him, it was so comfortable, and I like trusted him immediately, which was weird because it's like I don't really know this guy, but there was so much honesty. I never really felt like he was trying to – I don't really know how to explain it. It was just genuine, like, you know? He just is who he is, and I felt comfortable with him so quickly, and it felt kind of effortless, you know, that like he was just so easy to talk to and –
Yeah, I'd say comfort was a part of it. We hit it off pretty naturally, pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was some adjustment when we actually started living together.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You get to know the details, but.
For sure. The baggage starts coming out a little.
She learned I'm a bit of a slob, which took both adjustment on her part and correction on mine. you can only move the needle so much.
Was that a stark difference? Are you like a super clean person, or are you just like more middle of the road clean?
I am like more middle of the road. I'm not like a neat freak, but I don't like a lot of clutter. And it took some adjustment for sure.
Yeah.
Like I can be okay with a little bit of a mess for a few days, but then I'm like, oh my gosh, this is no. This has to be.
When would you say is like one of the first times where you guys started to face like conflict, difficulty, because up till now, like you guys love being around each other. Things have been pretty good. Moving in, everything feels like home, safe. It feels like a lot of safety.
Yeah.
What's one of the first, I'm not trying to take you back there, but like, do you remember having your first arguments or?
I don't even remember what our first fight was about. I think it was probably the house and the mess.
Yeah, that sounds right.
I feel like there was, like I was really frustrated with you, and I was like, "I'm gonna leave and go drive around for a little bit because I was mad." I remember that, and it was over the just housekeeping clutter differences, like trying to negotiate that and what that looks like. That was probably
something about me making a mess next to a coffee maker, and like, that was the last straw. I don't remember the details of it very well, but
yeah. How did you guys navigate conflict early on when it happened?
I tended to just try to avoid it.
Yeah.
Like, nope, okay, no conflict. And just pretend it's fine and I'll fix it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It took a while to realize that one, doesn't work as well as I hoped it would. And two, it doesn't really suit what she needs. Yeah. So it's me avoiding her trying to have a fight. You know, we're trying to have an argument here and I don't want it, which means it never gets resolved. We just kick the can down the road.
Yeah.
So eventually, all right, fine. We'll talk and we'll actually try to come to a solution. It's usually about something that we can address. You know, it tends to be a practical thing that there probably is some sort of a fix for, even if you can't fix it entirely.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. I think probably, you know, we had the first year of our marriage, and then in the second year of our marriage, both of my parents died that year. There were changes like in our careers. Like there was a lot that second year of marriage that was really
a lot of transition.
Really difficult. Yeah. So that I feel like really tested our relationship quite a bit.
Just how to get through it together, how to stay connected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause there was so much, you know, after my dad passed, my mom had cancer. So there was a lot of like trying to navigate ensuring she got to like her chemo treatments and things like that. So I felt like a lot of my attention was going, you know, to like my extended family and trying to, you know, navigate that.
And to lose both of your parents in that same year is
a lot. Yeah, that was a rough year for sure.
How did you guys support each other, you know, in spite of all the different external circumstances happening for you?
I could not have gotten through that year without him. I was like, I'm not going to cry.
It's so good. We love crying. We love tears.
My dad died in a car accident. So it was really, really shocking. Like just that just felt like a total daze. And then my mom was in palliative care for a couple of weeks at the hospital. And, you know, I come from big families. Yeah. My dad was the youngest of eight. My mom, the oldest of six. There's a lot of, you know, and they had this huge network of support, like in their church and community. So at the hospital, there was just people around all the time. And I'm the oldest. So a lot of the decisions, kind of navigating all of it, I kind of fell to me. And just like he would just be like, let's go for a walk, like outside the hospital, and just like, it's like he knew when I needed
grounding.
Yes. Grounding.
Yeah.
Yes. That's such a great way, I think, of explaining, like, you know, I just always feel so grounded with him.
Yeah.
I can be a little anxious, little ball.
Alan the regulator.
Like just.
Steady.
Yeah. And it's like, he just knows. And sometimes I think he knows me so much better than I know myself, because he knows what I need before I do.
Wow.
So being able to just say, let's go step outside. Like, let's go for a walk, or let's go down to the cafeteria and just sit and get away from all the stress and the overwhelm of all of it.
Yeah. So really, a lot of big transitions can kind of split and disconnect couples, but I'm hearing it made you guys trust even more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I saw my role as trying to figure out what she needed and to deliver that. Right? She's going through a horrible year.
Yeah.
You know, how do I help? So just pay attention and try to help. And that's consistently what I did.
Can you repeat that again? Because really, we would be out of a job if just all... repeat that one more time.
Also, I thought was like, it sounds like also you were accepting of help. Because that takes the feedback loop of, of like, I see what you need. Here's what I think. And then, okay, I'll sign on for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was enough trust between us early on that if I told her, I think maybe we should step out and focus on something else for a while, she would at least consider that maybe we needed to step out and focus on something else for a while.
Yeah.
Receptive. Yeah. And I think it's his way of communicating it too.
So you guys get through this really difficult year together. You grow stronger, more connected, more trusting of each other.
Yeah.
And then what's like the next, I don't know, big event in your timeline, or just take us through?
Around that time, I lost my job too. So that was...
You did lose your job.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, that's so much.
That was great.
Yeah. That was the next probably big transition, was him going back to school.
To law school, was that?
No, I went to... I had to finish my bachelor's degree. I dropped out of college back in, I guess, 2000.
Yeah.
And so I never finished my degree.
Yeah.
Went, turned a wrench as a mechanic for 10, 12 years. And then when I lost that job, I never liked being a mechanic. So we had to figure out what was next.
Yeah.
So we talked about it. And I tried to go back to school once, and it hadn't quite worked out for a few reasons. And then we decided that's what we were going to make happen. So I got admitted into a college a couple counties over.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if you know Kentucky, the counties are that big.
I don't. My twin sister lives in Kentucky.
And so I finished my bachelor's degree in history, and I realized I didn't really want to be a history teacher, because they end up just being the girls' volleyball coach. It's not what I was signing up for. So after we talked about it a bit, we just kind of decided law school would be a decent fit.
That's great. Yeah. And then that brought you out to
Tucson. That's what brought us to Tucson.
Yeah. And his parents live here too. So we wanted to be closer to them and had come to visit. We love Tucson, so we're hoping he would get into the U of A, and he did. So
wow.
3 years of law school, how was that?
It was a lot of work.
Yeah,
a lot of long nights. And she was the executive director of a small nonprofit here in town. So she was extremely busy too.
Yeah. And we just, did our thing for a few years. And then and he graduated, and then I decided to go back to school. So we've taken
turns.
Yeah. So we've really supported the other through that process.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things we, this came out of, you did a training for the rest of our therapists around grief, but can you tell us a little bit more, like specifically what that training was about?
Yeah. So the training was specifically around supporting couples through grieving as a result of infertility and pregnancy loss.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been doing grief work for like almost a decade now. I'm on the board for an organization that does a lot of trainings around grief and end of life. And so I'm really passionate about supporting people through the grieving process. And then through personal experience, we do not have children. That is not by choice. So we have had a lot of years of dealing with infertility and pregnancy losses.
I can feel it as you start to talk about it.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
What's it like to just even think about talking about it?
Oh, well, coming in today, I was really nervous about it. I don't talk a lot about myself and my story. Mm. And, you know, it's still painful. I've had numerous miscarriages and some that are fairly recent. 3 years ago, this is actually three years ago this week, I had an ectopic pregnancy, had ruptured my right fallopian tube, and I became septic.
Wow.
Ended up losing consciousness, passed out of my carport. He took me to the hospital. I was septic and I'd lost a lot of blood. I had 2 blood transfusions and emergency surgery. So I almost died.
Wow.
It was a really difficult situation to navigate. So particularly after that, going through that experience, just became more interested in
wow.
how women and individuals deal with, you know, the aftermath of these losses that compound. So I was in grad school getting my master's in counseling when all of this happened. So I ended up doing a research paper on the topic for my trauma and crisis class. And as I dug into the research, it was staggering, the numbers that you see. And it's a topic that nobody really talks about.
Yeah.
You know, as you start sharing your story, you hear other people that are like, oh, I had this experience. And as I've talked to other individuals who have dealt with it, you know, what they share with me is so similar to what I experienced. But there's so much pain and there's shame. And so as a society, we just don't really talk about that topic or address it in a way that's supportive for a lot of people.
What did you guys notice about the unique like experience that each of you had, you know, like, I mean, because the woman's experience and the male's experience in this, I mean, are starkly different, right? Like, I mean, Alan, do you mind talking a little bit about like, what was it like for you?
At what point? You know, for me, the ectopic pregnancy and the emergency surgery, that was stressful in a very acute sort of way. How do I make sure that we get a good outcome here? There's literally nothing I can do.
Right.
I get her to the hospital and it's entirely out of my hands.
Yeah.
So I'm waiting to see literally if she's going to survive. So that was extremely stressful.
Yeah.
After she gets home, there's a couple weeks where at least there's something I can do. You know, I can try to take care of her a little bit. After that, you know, you start to, you know, process what's occurred, how this actually affects, you know, our relationship, how it affects potential, right? That's I think one of the big differences,
right.
Is that, you know, for me, it's a loss of what could have been. Mm-hmm. And the fact that she survived is the thing I'm most grateful for. And
right.
that was so overwhelming for a while that I didn't really think much for a few months
just
about
happy that you're just okay.
that she's still around. Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't think all that much about, you know, what that meant for the family we're not going to have in the future. Mm-hmm. And that's a hard thing for me.
That's a hard thing. Yeah.
And it's hard to say that, I don't know how to put it because on the one hand there is this loss, but for me, I didn't carry the baby. I have no idea. It wasn't a real thing for me. It was a possibility that then was ripped away. And so I have to keep in mind that for her, it was more of a real thing. It happened to her. So I put a lot of my effort for a long time emotionally into trying to, you know, maintain some stability and talk about what she needed to talk about. And, eventually there comes a point where we've had a couple of conversations, and you just have to figure out, how are we going to accept that this is what has happened, and this is how things are going to play out.
Yeah. Our relationship renovation at home manual for couples is now available on Amazon for $24.99. Check it out. It's going to be so helpful. It's going to be giving you all of the skills and tools we talk about on our podcast. So please go check it out. Your relationship is so worth this.
What's coming up for you as you hear him talk about it?
He saved my life. Wow. He did.
Yeah, she wasn't going to go to the hospital. We were on the phone, and she passed out in the carport. And she was only out for a few seconds, but I heard her go down, and I knew she had fallen. So I was out the door, because I was at the office. I was out the door and driving home. And she came too, and we started talking, and I stayed on the phone with her until I got home. And then I told her she wanted to just go to bed. I told her, no, you've got 10 minutes, and either you're getting in the car or an ambulance is going to come and carry you into the ambulance. Those are your two options.
My brain was not functioning properly at the time. I lost a lot of blood.
She took her 10 minutes. My defense. And then I helped her out the door, and we went to the nearest emergency room, and they took way too long to triage and figure out what was wrong with her. But once they realized what was going on, they were right on it.
Yeah. I mean, what I'm hearing a little bit is, like, for you in that experience, but then also in the entire experience, there was a lot of attention you always sort of needed to, but it also sort of fit into your schema, right? Of like, what can I do? How can I take care?
Yes.
And then you wouldn't have to deal with what maybe you were actually feeling.
Absolutely.
But there was a point where that had to come around. Like, how did you get to that point where you're like, okay, I actually have to
process this grief.
Yeah, what's going on?
What could have been?
Yeah, I don't really know. The emotional focus, so to speak, gradually was able to ease up a little bit. I didn't need to do as much for her. I didn't need to focus as much. And that just made a little bit of room for processing in the back of my mind.
Just like came forward.
To, you know, really think through what had happened and what that means going forward.
What was that like for you when you began to see? Could you tell that his process was shifting?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was, Alan, even in the processing of emotions, is pretty private. So getting him to open up and share, I kind of know when to lean in, you know, figured out when to lean in, when he might be open to talking about it, and then when he needs his space to process it. Maybe, you know, that is him going and doing something, you know, outside of the house where he has that time to really think through. So I've tried to encourage him to do those things, you know, like the float tank. He really likes to do that. So it's like, cool. you should book that. Because I know he sometimes doesn't want to share because he doesn't want to worry me or burden me with it, and he needs that time. So knowing when he's ready to talk about it, like trying to discern that and read that, has been something I've learned throughout our marriage, but through this process as well, when he's ready to talk about the things that, you know, we need to talk about, trying to find that balance and discernment with him.
Can I make an observation? Mm-hmm. The level of compassion and empathy that you both have for yourselves and each other, where a lot of these experiences tear couples apart because my needs aren't getting met and why is he withdrawing? Like, it is starkly different from what normally happens when trauma happens in your relationship. Like, you guys, you're giving each other the space, the attunement, the awareness. I know when to lean in. I know when to give space. This is both of you. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen it this way, but like that resilience in your relationship is, It's like why you're here today. It's why you started to choose this area for your growth because of your own suffering so you could help others. It's just amazing to witness and see and feel in the room. Because usually it's about during this time they left me, like not physically, but.
What was that process like of like knowing when to connect about it, right? You know, and like not letting there be too much space. Yeah. Like that you, because that's what happens, you know, even couples where there's not like high conflict around this, where there's frustration, but there's just that, you know, just sort of slowly trending in opposite directions. Like what would you say? Because, you know, couples want to hear, like they want to understand somebody who's able to do this in a way that they remain connected and maybe become more deeply connected. Like, how did you navigate that, like not just drifting apart?
I think that proximity and emotional closeness consistently over time is really what did it, because there were times when she wanted to talk about things that I was not ready to talk about, and I wanted to talk about things that she was not ready to talk about. And not viewing that as a rejection, but no, we're still going to just be here together.
Let's stay close.
And if it doesn't, you know, if we don't have the conversation that we want to have, so be it. You know, we're still gonna be close. We're still gonna talk about something. We're gonna express love for each other in some way.
It's trust.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's trust and a willingness to acknowledge that just because you're not necessarily getting what you might feel that you need in that moment from the other person doesn't mean that you're being rejected.
That they're like purposefully holding something.
Oh my gosh.
You know, maybe they're just not ready to do it.
And I think we've had experiences with grief prior to this. So understanding that we are at different phases of that grieving process.
Yeah.
You know, we're not always at the same place with that. So I think the recognition of we each have our own kind of individual way of processing through that. But we're still doing it together. We just might not be in the exact same place at the same time.
And that's okay.
And that's okay. That doesn't mean that, to Alan's point, that we're rejecting the other person. It's just, I'm just not there yet.
I mean, that kind of speaks to when you did your training, there was a certain model that you use around grief. And I think it was like 4 stages.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea that you're going to move through those stages at different paces, at different times.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it just helped on some level at least have one person that was like, had that awareness of just like around grief itself, like that knowledge was helpful? Or was it just unique? Like, this is just sort of like how our relationship is built.
Hmm. It might be a little bit of both of that, you know? Yeah. And I mean, we did have experience, you know, through grief, but this was different. This is a grief, like the pregnancy losses over and over. That's a level of grief. And I don't want to speak for you, but for me, that is the worst grief I've ever experienced.
Just the repetitive nature of it, or what was?
No, it's more about just the compounding nature of it when you have multiple losses. But then it's not just the loss of a child, but it's your future. It's things that you've dreamed of. To see like how happy he was when I was pregnant, I've never seen him so happy. And then that has just been like ripped away over and over again. And that, like, I can't give that to him, you know, like the pain of that. He's an amazing person. He's my favorite person. And I would love nothing more than to give him that. And I can't. And so the pain of that is really, really challenging.
Have you had that awareness for throughout this process of what that dynamic she's talking about?
I think so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How have you helped her through that?
I don't really have a specific answer to that. I try to be around. I try to be, you know, supportive. I try to be open with my emotions to the extent that I'm capable of doing that. you know, I'm naturally very even-tempered, and I don't always process my emotions quickly. Like, I'll feel something, and she'll point out, you seem irritated about it. Like, I'm not irritated.
Oh, maybe
I am. Maybe I might be. So I don't know that I can, you know, provide a roadmap or anything to how we actually have navigated any of this.
You said a couple of things. You said one thing twice, and it seems like super important. You, first time you used the word proximity, and then the second time you said you just stayed close. And it sounds like that's something you're identifying as, like, you just stayed close, whether it's actually physical presence or showing up with questions or just being there emotionally, that there was that you're identifying that mattered.
Yeah, I think it did. Making time and realizing that, you know, after an event like this, and when you're trying to process, you know, how the next years of your life are going to go as a consequence of an unexpected event, you need to be in the same room a fair bit. You got to check in regularly, and it can't be just coincidence because you happen to live in the same place. You have to actually interact with each other and
intentional talk. Intentional
proxies. Yeah, and you don't have to talk about, you don't have to talk about any of the bad things.
Yeah.
Just be there and, you know, try not to put up the emotional walls that are sometimes easier because you just block out the pain that way.
I'm also wondering, like, I have this, first of all, thank you both for being so vulnerable and sharing, and that closeness, that proximity, whatever you're talking about, it like connects, like, I'm enough, even though this is our reality. And I wish I could give Alan, like, what I saw made him so happy, but like that you're enough regardless of the reality. I don't quite know, but it feels like that's what's very true.
Well, it is true. and I've tried to make sure that she understands that you know, I didn't, at no point has our relationship or my interest in and connection to her been dependent on anything that we've lost as a result of miscarriages. Like, I wanted a family, but I want her first. And I've tried to communicate that to her in what ways I can. And I think, you know, maybe at times I've been a little too deferential to her emotions. Because sometimes she'll ask me what I'm feeling, and like, either I don't know, or I'm just not willing to talk about it right now because I don't I don't want to upset her. You know, and maybe that's a balance that I haven't gotten perfect, but you know,
working on it.
It's still, you know, we're good.
The thing about Alan is, even if he isn't ready to talk about his, he always holds space for mine.
Yeah,
always. Like, he never, and I think that is, like, our entire marriage is that he doesn't shy away from sitting with me when I am going through it and I need to express it. He's always been there, and he might not, you know, he doesn't even really need to say anything. Just having that closeness and knowing that he is there, it's made, like, all, I think, all the difference in ours, in our relationship, that he does hold that space for me when I need it.
I mean, to me, it's like, because grief, I don't think a lot of people identify grief, right? They get anger, frustrated, confused, why me? When you put grief on it, but it's almost like when you're into that deep suffering, he's like Alan the regulator. Like, you're not rupturing, which a lot of people do, and then it goes into complicated grief and it feels terrible. But like, it's almost like when you're into those deep wounds and that suffering, and even maybe in a negative place yourself because something that you really want just isn't possible right now, that just being with him regulates that. Mm-hmm. And that so many people, whether that's grief, whether that's, you know, transitions, they don't have that regulation piece with the other person, right? So now it like becomes threatening. Mm-hmm. And can you imagine what that would be like if you didn't have Alan, yet somebody more reactive and stop feeling this way? And I think that's why when you are doing your in-service, just like recognizing grief, that's mm-hmm. a word that feels like we can both work on this. That feels softer versus it's your fault, it's my fault, I'm not enough, maybe we shouldn't be together, you name it. And what happens, you know, to all couples who are dealing with a lot of this pregnancy mm-hmm. loss and infertility. I mean, you see it, you're working with it now. And is it, am I right? Is it, do you want it to be your specialty?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to support, you know, couples who are dealing with this, this issue, because there are so many people who are going through it. We were actually talking about it this morning on our way here. And Alan, you made such a great point about it's common, but it's also
invisible.
Invisible.
Yeah.
And that combination of the two. Mm-hmm. It's considered a disenfranchised loss, so it's not really even recognized socially as something that people grieve.
Yeah.
So, you know, as you're talking, you know, as I've shared more, you know, so many people have shared with me, you know, yes, I've had this experience, and it's so intimate, you know, and it's hard to talk about because it's incredibly complex. There's many layers to it. Even socially, you know, people that in our circle, some of the things that have been said, like, oh, you can try again, or, you know, all these comments, and they're well-intentioned.
Totally.
You know, I mean, everybody that has shared, it's...
But a little dismissive at the same time, right?
Yeah, it can be very dismissive.
Which then makes you feel like, am I crazy for having these big feelings? And
well, because it says, like, you can't be wherever you happen to be in that moment with it. You just should... Really just, I guess they're saying like, move forward, just move forward. Don't feel. Yeah. So, I mean, there are couples out there that are in some place in this journey. Right. And I think people like to hear like, well, how will this journey evolve? Right. And for you guys who are two people who've managed to stay connected, to stay loving, to work through it, where are you now? You know, where do you guys feel like you are now in this process?
I guess I feel like we're trying to figure out what comes next, right? We had ideas about how our lives might play out. And, you know, we were, I think when she had her ectopic pregnancy, we were starting to think maybe we're probably not going to have kids. And then that happens. And briefly for a month, we thought, oh, maybe this is something we do get. Then that gets ripped away, and now we're trying to figure out, you know, what's the plan for the future? You know, we're both in our 40s, you know, even by any expectation, we've got at least 20 years to go. If we're both fortunate, it could be 40. What are we going to do at that time, right? Can it be taken up entirely with work? Do we have to figure out what our purpose is, not just individually, but like together, you know, what are we supposed to do? And that's, there's a lot of thought and discussion that's going to go into that. We've started the process, but we haven't answered that question yet.
Yeah. Cause I've, you know, it's interesting. Like after the ectopic, I was like, well, I probably can't get pregnant again. Well, I can. Like I've had miscarriages since then. So it's happened. But I think we're at a place where I think we've accepted.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So now it's like renegotiating. Like, what does our future look like? There were challenges, you know, on my end with intimacy.
Yeah.
Like it. I was afraid. Sure. I had a lot of trauma after the ectopic, and I had flashbacks. I had PTSD from it. And so getting to a place where I could like enjoy the intimacy again has taken, I mean, it's taken years to get back there.
Yeah.
So just, you know, from that perspective too, like, you know, trying to build that connection and enjoy things again. And then on top of that, what does our future look like? And we don't have an answer right now. Like, that's where we're in the negotiation phase of that. Like, what is our future? What does our future look like? What are we working towards? What do we want for the next 40 years or so?
Well, it feels like it's intentional time and space that we're still figuring it out, and all these other, like you said, layers of PTSD and getting safe with intimacy again and inside your own body. Like, there's not just this fix it and this is how you do it. It's a time thing. Mm-hmm. And you guys are staying emotionally connected and in proximity. You're here talking about it to the world today. It sounds like it's okay that you don't have an answer, but you're in negotiations, whatever that means for the two of you.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things as therapists we talk to people about is like the ability to feel multiple things that are sort of like contrary to each other, right? And like when you say that about like we don't know, you know, we're figuring out, we're in acceptance around certain things, and we're trying to figure out what is the future. And so there's this part of me that's like, oh, like there's like something like really like wonderful and exciting about like what could it be, but then at the same time you're saying like, but yeah, but we're still at the same time we're still grieving, right? We know this process of grief is not linear, and we're still, you know, there's after effects from different aspects of this, and holding the space for that is, you know, it sounds like that has always been you guys' strength, you know, from early on, from the second year when a lot of things happened, job losses of parents, big moves, career shifts, is like the sort of like the through line for you has always been like, wow, we stay connected.
Got each other's backs.
And we're also like really attuned to each other. And, you know, that's a big thing that we talk about couples is that attunement and responsiveness that I like, I'm paying attention to what's going on and I'm doing my best to respond to my partner in a way that's going to help us stay connected. And so, I mean, you guys, it's like super inspiring. You know, you're both very like thoughtful, loving people. Like you can feel it. I can feel it.
Oh, I can feel it too. Can I ask a question? If there's a individual couple listening to this, right, and they're experiencing loss, infertility, and maybe they're not feeling connected and on the same page, like what would you say to this person or this couple?
I think one thing is going back to just the understanding that what you're going through is tremendously painful, and that you might not be on the same page when it comes to grief or like navigating, you know, that future, but really carving out that intentional time with one another to just be there with each other. Grief is complex, and it is not linear, to your point. Like, it's going to come in waves. It's going to ebb and flow, and you're not going to be at the same place at grief as your partner is. But just kind of recognizing that the two of you are in it together. Like, there is no one else in this fight with you but this other person.
Yeah.
Like, there's no one else. It's just the two of us dealing with this big life-changing experience. It's not just the loss of not having, you know, a child, but like we'll never be parents, we'll never be grandparents. The milestones that you expect to have, you know, the first day of kindergarten, like all of those things are gone. Your identity as, you know, parents, like renegotiating, like what are our roles now? But there's nobody else in that but the other person. Like there's nobody in it but me, but you, right? Nobody else can. So you're kind of in this fight together and just maintaining that proximity and allowing space for the other person to express what they need to express, you know, and being with them.
And I would add that just because you're on the same, you're both in the same boat, doesn't mean you need to actually understand what the other one is feeling at all times. You don't, right? This is, it's different for men and women.
Mm-hmm.
And I think don't expect or demand that the other person really understands what you're feeling. Just be there to listen to them.
Yeah.
Because you're only going to understand each other if you don't react negatively when somebody expresses themselves or fails to.
Absolutely.
Right. And if it seems like the other person is reacting in a way that just doesn't make sense, they're putting up walls that don't need to be there, maybe try to figure out why.
Yes.
Don't pressure, don't interrogate, which I have a tendency to interrogate sometimes.
Oh, you're going to be
conversations
you're
like
lawyer.
The depositions. but listen, and if it doesn't entirely make sense to you, that's okay.
That's okay. Yeah. It's like all of these comments that you made today, Alan, that I want to like have in our like little shorts and be like, you won't ever need couples counseling or coaching if, and then Alan's this, Alan, this comment, Alan's, I like really want to do like a highlighted reel because it's so profound and it's so true. Like when I'm going through something, whether it's right perimenopause and EJ, if he's like, yeah, I can understand that. It's like, no, you can't, but that's okay. But just be curious about me.
Yeah.
Like, what's that like for you to like feel like your body has been taken over by an alien? Help me understand more. Like, just that curiosity. And you keep like referring to, I call it Michael Singer, I think it is, heart with ears. Just like your heart ears, there's nothing else. It doesn't have to be what you need. It doesn't have to meet expectations. There's no assumptions. It's just, I'm here, my heart's here, my ears are here. Yeah, and it's okay. And if your experience is different than mine, that's okay.
Well, thank you so much, Casey. Thank you, Alan. Thank you just for sharing your story. Thank you for being two like really wonderful people going through something, you know, really tough and being willing to share it with people. Because like you said, it's incredibly common and it's invisible. And today you're helping it become visible to some people who would, I'm sure would really appreciate that. So thank you.
Thank you. And I hope that whatever the future is, like you are just so deserving of so much. You guys are just amazing humans and the love you have for each other and your relationship, despite all of the stressful, traumatic events you guys have gone through, it's profound. Truly. So just to wrap up, again, we love hearing couple stories and just the resilience and the courage and the compassion and the empathy that we all deserve. We deserve to have someone by our side who loves us unconditionally, no matter what, that we are enough, that we are visible. So thank you, Casey and Alan. Thank you so much for listening. As always, take care of yourself. Take care of each other. Bye-bye.
Singing on the train, me and you listening to the rain. Me and you, we are the same. Me and you have all the fame we need. Indeed, you and me, are we?